had the same reaction to the materials they were given. Just 1 month later, on December 19th, 2005, Randy received notification from the U.S. Marshal's Office in Columbia, South Carolina, that a federal indictment had been issued. I was under arrest, along with 9 other prior executives of Medical Manager Corporation. I was to turn myself in to the federal authorities at an arraignment on December 28th in Charleston, South Carolina. The summons read, United States of America versus Michael A. Singer. Chapter 53, Preparing a Defense. I thought I pretty much understood what I was up against until I saw the indictment. In all honesty, it was about the furthest thing from the truth that I had ever seen in my life. I knew that Bobby had implicated us by telling the government that we were aware of everything he had done wrong. In the eyes of the law, that would have made us co-conspirators. But the indictment didn't even include Bobby David's name. It listed all the things he claimed to have done improperly and stated that the executives did these things, or more precisely, caused them to happen. We were all facing conspiracy charges that could result in up to 15 years in prison. I was floored when I first read the indictment. Randy was not. It was just about what he had expected based on his 30 years of experience. The indictment represented the government's story in the strongest possible language to justify the charges. Truth, on the other hand, could hopefully emerge from the fires of the trial. So far, there had been absolutely no pushback against Bobby's view of the world. We had, in fact, not yet begun to fight. I met Randy and my South Carolina attorney, John Simmons, in Charleston for the arraignment. All 10 of the indicted medical manager executives were there, along with more than 20 of our attorneys. Joining me were John Kang, John Sessions, Rick Carl, David Ward, 2 regional vice presidents, the chief financial officer, an accounting comptroller, and the attorney who had worked on the dealer acquisition program. It was quite a circus. Before the court proceedings, we all had to get booked and fingerprinted by the FBI. Needless to say, that was a first-time experience for all of us. When we were finally brought together outside the courtroom, it was the first time many of us had seen each other for years. We had built a successful company together, and there was still real friendship and camaraderie between us. The attorneys preferred that we not speak to one another, but that just wasn't going to happen. The scene turned into a reunion with warm handshakes and hugs. Each of us knew in our hearts that we had not done the things we were being accused of. Perhaps the sense of a common enemy brought us even closer together. All I know is that by the time the prosecutor showed up, it looked more like a social gathering than an arraignment. I really wanted to meet the prosecutor. I didn't hold anything against her. In fact, I felt a strange kinship with her because we both had been duped by the same con artist, Bobby Davids. The difference being that I knew it and she didn't. Against Randy's better judgment, but with his permission, I introduced myself to her. She shook my hand, but it was very clear that she didn't like me very much. It was the first time we had ever met, but she had already built a Mickey Singer inside her head, who I'm sure I'd rather not meet. The proceedings progressed smoothly, except that instead of one defendant and his attorney standing before the judge, we had to squeeze in 10 defendants and 20 attorneys. The courtroom was quite small, and the public seating area was completely filled with the remainder of our legal teams. The room was so packed that the jury box was being used to hold 10 to 12 inmates in orange jumpsuits who were waiting their turn to see the judge. I was standing right next to the jury box, and these inmates reminded me of my group back in prison. I allowed myself to think that the way things were going, that could be me someday. I knew if I was going to be at peace throughout this ordeal, I would have to be comfortable with that thought. I just let go and relaxed into the moment. I was standing in a South Carolina courtroom being arraigned, but I was overcome with love for those inmates sitting next to me. Randy had to nudge me to stand up straight and pay attention to the proceedings. All I knew is that I was on the journey of my life, and just look where it had taken me. The judge released us on our own recognizance without the need to post bail. Though we were free to leave, I lingered in that courtroom for a while and wondered what it had in store for me. These were very unique moments in one's life. Best not to miss them. I spent time with some of the executives afterwards. I hadn't seen Rick Carr for many years, but that hadn't affected our close friendship. He told me that he had been nominated for a federal judgeship in Florida. Indications were that he would have received the appointment, but he had to pull his name the moment he heard he had been indicted. Likewise, John Kang was preparing to step down as chairman and CEO of the public company he and his brother had started. Everyone was putting their best face forward, but this situation was altering people's lives. Aside from these executives and their families, the front page publicity from the indictment had affected some other people very dear to me. I had already received a call from the warden at Union Correctional Institution saying that until this situation was resolved, he had no choice but to revoke my authorization to meet with my Saturday morning group. After 30 years of committing myself to perhaps the most important thing I had done in my life, my prison work was over. A wave of darkness was falling over everything that had been the source of so much light. It was all completely out of my control. I was determined to sit peacefully deep inside and see if it could pass by without affecting my inner state. It was like the early years when I had first started my experiment of letting go in the face of perceived danger. The big difference now was that this danger was way beyond anything I could have ever imagined. It was the perfect storm. Meanwhile, it had been over 2 years since the raid. The government was required by law to disclose all the materials investigators had seized. Yet by the time of the arraignment, we had no documents with which to prepare a defense. That evening, the entire joint defense group got together at the hotel. I really enjoyed watching all the attorneys interact. Randy had taken the lead in putting together a joint defense agreement that would allow us to share materials. But in the end, each attorney was responsible for their own client's best interest. Surrounded by a room full of criminal defense attorneys, I realized that I was in an amazing situation. I was about to embark on a very personal tour of the American justice system. I knew I had never even thought of doing the things I was accused of. But how is this going to turn out? Would our great system of justice work? A month later, we began to receive the first wave of disclosure materials. We gained access to the 1.2 million email messages taken during the raid, as well as notes from some of the FBI interviews. It would be 5 more months before we had any access to the millions of pages of paper documents that had been seized, not to mention the hundreds of thousands of computer files that had been copied during the raid. The government had almost 3 years to review all this material. It was going to take the defense years to work through it. Once the disclosure materials began arriving, Randy and his Baker Botts team kept giving me tasks to do. Review these tens of thousands of email messages. Review all 6 years of notes from the executive meetings. Review all my written responses to years of nightly take-home work. I would periodically go up to D.C. to work with the team on specific items. There were always 4 or 5 attorneys from Baker Botts working on the case on my behalf. All the other executives' attorneys also had dedicated teams, though not always as large. The further we got into the material, the more obvious it became No one, except Bobby and his group, had done anything wrong. There were no email messages or documents that showed any executive instructing or even implying that a county should be done improperly. We had 30 to 40 of our attorneys buried in these documents solely to find anything that could tie us to Bobby's misdeeds. No one found any hard evidence against any of the defendants. Unfortunately, since we had worked with Bobby Davis on a regular basis, there would always be circumstantial evidence that could be exploited to mean whatever you wanted it to mean. This was the backdrop under which I wrote The Untethered Soul. To the core of my being, I wanted to communicate to others that they were deep inside listening to that voice's incessant chatter, and there was a way they could be free. That was the work of my life, not this absurd legal mess. I didn't care how threatening this non-truth had become. I wanted to share a deep truth that would brighten the lives of others. I committed myself to the book. Karen and I had finished writing by late 2006, but we were still doing editing passes. I sent an early draft to Randy because I wanted to get his feedback. I also needed my attorney's permission to do just about anything that might affect the case. Randy was very concerned that the government prosecutors would find a way to use the book against me, as they had been doing with everything else. I told him that I was willing to take that risk, especially since we had no idea where the case would end up. I needed to get the book published as soon as possible. Having discussed the risks, Randy left the decision to me. Getting The Untethered Soul published came together very quickly. I had given an early draft to James O.D., a dear friend of mine who was on the Temple's Board of Trustees. As the perfection of life would have it, James was the director of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, IONS, at the time, and they had just signed a co-publishing arrangement with New Harbinger Publications, the country's foremost psychology book publisher. They all read the book and loved it. Given how everything else in my life was being pulled toward the abyss, it amazed me to see these energies flow so smoothly. The Untethered Soul was launched in September 2007. I bypassed the customary promotional book signing tour and declined all interviews. I knew it was an author's responsibility to promote their book, especially during the launch, so I informed New Harbinger that I would handle the publicity by way of the Internet. Karen and I devised a marketing strategy, and without leaving the woods of Alachua, we poured time and money into promoting the book. The results were phenomenal. New Harbinger's first press run of The Untethered Soul was supposed to last a year. We ran out of books in just 3 months. The book has continued to sell very well on its own after the launch, including internationally. In the midst of that intensely dark period, the book managed to manifest, sprout wings, and soar off around the globe. The feedback from everywhere was overwhelming. The Untethered Soul was fulfilling its purpose. It was helping people. In the midst of phenomenal darkness, it was spreading light. Chapter 54, The Constitution and the Bill of Rights. The legal battle was definitely getting more interesting. Once we had access to the disclosure materials, we could prepare a defense. The first thing Randy and the defense team did was ask the judge to force the government to cut the scope of the materials down to size. They couldn't just hand us millions and millions of email messages, documents, and computer files, as well as years of accounting entries, and then say somewhere in there is what you did wrong. If we were going to have a chance of defending ourselves, claims of wrongdoing needed to be more specific. In legal terms, this is called requesting a bill of particulars. The government fought it, but the judge issued an order forcing prosecutors to specify exactly which dealer acquisitions and which accounting entries they were going to present at trial. In all these years of seeing the truth manipulated until it became unrecognizable. This was the first time I saw that we had some say in the matter. The U.S. Department of Justice is one of the most powerful forces in the world, but it is not all-powerful. The judge had the right to overrule the DOJ. I reminded myself that this was not the case in lots of other countries. If those governments were convinced that you did something wrong, it was pretty much over. As long as I had to go through this ordeal, I wanted to learn all I could about our legal system. I asked Randy what exactly gave us the right to make this demand of the government. I really loved his answer, the Constitution. The Sixth Amendment says, "The accused shall enjoy the right to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusations." Supreme Court rulings through the years have interpreted this right to mean that if the disclosure materials presented to you are too broad, you have the right to demand a bill of particulars. I didn't tell Randy at the time, but that moved me to the core of my being. For 3 years, I've been sitting quietly deep inside myself, watching the powers that be take Bobby's lies and turn them into a seemingly unstoppable force of destruction. Suddenly, I was reminded that people I'd never met had possessed the caring and foresight to make sure I had rights. If it was going to be the United States of America versus Michael A. Singer, I had some very great people in my corner. Thomas Jefferson, George Mason, and James Madison, to name just a few. Over the next few years, it would become painfully obvious to me that only a single piece of paper stood between me and the dark abyss. That piece of paper was the U.S. Constitution. I went back and read the Constitution, beginning to end. From the perspective of my predicament, it was so evident that the Founding Fathers were not only creating a government, they were protecting the people from it. I had always known this intellectually, but now it was personal, very personal. This was not a civics course. It was my life. Under these circumstances, the Constitution really came alive for me. Throughout 2007, the Joint Defense Group worked on finding all relevant documents regarding the items the government had listed on the Bill of Particulars. I went up to Washington a few days each month for review meetings and also had regular conference calls with the legal team at Baker Botts. Randy was present for almost all the meetings, and his partner, Casey Cooper, and the associate attorneys handled much of the day-to-day work. Each associate had been assigned a share of the dealer acquisitions to thoroughly reconstruct, and we would review each of these transactions in painstaking detail. It was like having a jackhammer taken to my ego. I had built and run a beautiful company. We had a great product, great employees, and great clients, and we had been very successful. But underneath the dealer acquisition program, there was filth. It was like looking into a cesspool. Bobby had been stealing, lying, manipulating, and controlling everything in his world, including me and the rest of the executives. It took my breath away to see what he had done. Behind it all was the realization that these meetings were not about what Bobby had done. They were about the fact that he had managed to find a way to make us criminally responsible for what he had done. It was like being in the Twilight Zone. All I could do was keep letting go at the deepest possible level. My mantra was, "This is reality. Deal with it." I just took the attitude that on my journey through life, I was now part of this excellent legal team that had been pulled together to defend this poor sap Singer who had been framed by the evil villain. I took a breath, let go, and contributed positively to the topic being discussed. We were definitely making headway. We had discovered that the disk drive the government gave us that held data from people's personal computer files had been indexed improperly by the FBI. For some reason, the agents had only indexed the files by the short description header they had assigned to each file. The contents of the files had not been indexed for search purposes. This severely limited the search results of this important source of data. The defense team had a full indexing done, and we were finding lots of interesting historical documents. We found early drafts of documents and letters that directly contradicted some of the lies Bobby had told. Little by little, we were unraveling the convoluted mess he had created. Judge Blatt was our judge, and Randy was doing really well with him. We were having regular pretrial hearings, and Judge Blatt was approving many, but not all, of our motions. Randy found him to be very fair in his rulings and felt that the judge was beginning to get a sense of how far the government had stretched its case. It had been more than 4 years since the raid, and things were finally beginning to look up. I couldn't have felt more confident in Randy as my lead attorney and as the leading figure in the joint defense group. Things began to unravel in 2008. Randy informed me on February 7th that he had gone in for a checkup and they had found a tumor. It was cancerous and they wanted to operate immediately. They ripped open his chest and cut out the tumor. In the midst of the battle, the general was down. It only took 3 or 4 weeks for Randy to be back on his feet leading the charge. But there was a lingering issue. The doctors said there was a good chance that the tumor could return and he should consider chemotherapy. He decided to wait and see, hoping for the best. In the meantime, it was back to work. That was a good thing, because the government had been petitioning the judge to finally set a trial date. We had been telling the judge that due to the sheer volume of the disclosure materials, we were nowhere near ready. But in June 2008, the judge gave us our trial date, February 2nd, 2009, just 7 months away. We had so much work left to do. It really was going to take an army of attorneys. Halfway to the trial date, Randy's cancer returned. This time, he was going to need 8 weeks of very intense chemotherapy and an indeterminate recovery period. I remembered back to when Jim Mercer was advising me about choosing an attorney. He said the holy grail would be to get a senior partner from one of the country's premier firms who would be personally committed to your case alone. Randy had turned out to be that holy grail. Now, against his doctor's advice, Randy was seriously considering risking his life by waiting until the trial was over before starting his treatment. I assured him that I would have none of that, but he decided to wait and see how fast the tumor was progressing before making his decision. Randy was like a samurai warrior who had finally been given a battle that was about honor, truth, and justice. He was not about to lay down his sword for a tiny tumor. Unfortunately, it only took a month for the tumor to progress to the point that there was no longer a decision. We knew Judge Blatt was adamant that there would not be any extensions to the trial date. Though it was a long shot, Randy requested a 3-month extension so that he could represent me at trial. Once again, it was the Constitution that took care of me. The motion filed invoked my Sixth Amendment right to have the assistance of counsel of my choice. Though the government opposed the motion for an extension, it was granted by the judge under the condition that I begin working with another lead attorney in case Randy did not recover in time. With the new trial date set for May 4th, 2009, just 5 months away, Randy began his treatment. I had been working with Randy for more than 5 years by then. He had not only been my lead attorney and good friend, but he was also the chief legal strategist for the entire joint defense group. There was no replacing him. Having promised the judge I would do just that, at least as a backup, I took a deep breath and surrendered to the reality before me. I would have to start working with a new lead attorney. Chapter 55, Divine Intervention. The workload increased significantly as we moved toward trial. In February, we started a very interesting and important phase of the pretrial hearings, motions in limine. These were pretrial motions that gave us the opportunity to challenge whether the evidence the government prosecutors intended to present at trial was, in fact, trustworthy from a legal perspective. They had taken document after document and defined them in a way that seemed to support their version of events. I knew for a fact that many of the documents didn't say what they were being twisted to say, but taken out of context, they would influence a jury. I was pleased to learn that the courts had interpreted our constitutional right to a fair trial to mean that a jury could not be prejudiced with evidence that did not meet a reasonable standard of trustworthiness. In other words, we had the right to petition the judge to exclude some of this material from the trial altogether. Motion by motion, we challenged the relevance and/or trustworthiness of what the government intended to present to the jury. In many cases, the judge agreed with us. This judge was finally reining in the unbridled attempts to create evidence by arbitrarily assigning meaning to documents and events. I was not attending any of the pretrial hearings, but I was reviewing all the motions and following with great interest as they had their day in court. With Randy out, the associate attorney, Alex Walsh, would give me the daily updates. I was really impressed with her and could see how Randy's absence afforded tremendous opportunity for the younger attorneys. I loved seeing that out of this darkness, something great was being forged. Randy completed his chemotherapy and tried to come back to work right away. But though the therapy was successful, it would take a few months before he got his full strength back. In late March, just 1 month from trial, we learned that Randy's recovery period was not our only concern. On March 27th, 2009, Judge Blatt announced that because of his age and his health, he was stepping down from the case. We had lost our judge. The saber rattling began immediately. The government sent out word to all defense counsel that they had better come in and negotiate a plea because they were going to be destroyed in trial with a new judge. Needless to say, given how well Judge Blatt had come to know the case over the last 3.5 years and how fair he had been, the prospect of a new judge at the 11th hour was disheartening. In the midst of the most dangerous situation of my life, the two forces in this world I had come to have the most confidence in to protect me, Randy and Judge Blatt, were both taken away. This amazing sequence of events was so completely out of my control that I had no choice but to surrender at an even deeper level. It seemed like life was finally unfolding in a way that would assure the demise of whatever was left of my personal self, just what I had asked it to do so many years ago. No one knew what was going to happen next. The trial date would almost certainly have to be reset, but no one had any idea of a new date or who the judge would be. All we could do was continue to make sure we were ready, just in case. The chief district judge, Judge Norton, took charge of finding a federal judge who could handle a 4-month-long trial on short notice. In the meantime, Judge Blatt continued to hold pretrial hearings, and we continued to do very well with our motions in limine. Finally, unable to find a replacement judge, Judge Norton decided to take the case himself. At a hearing in July, we were given the new trial date of January 18th, 2010, which was 5 months away. So now the Chief U.S. District Judge of South Carolina was going to hear the case. Everything just kept getting bigger and bigger. Judge Norton took over the pretrial hearings around August 2009. By then, Randy was fully back in the saddle and he found Judge Norton to be very bright, knowledgeable, and impartial. It turned out that Judge Norton's rulings were very similar to Judge Blatt's. We continued to tear down the government's case in pretrial motions throughout the months leading up to trial. It certainly appeared that the new judge, like the old, saw the weakness of the case being brought against us. By October, we were 3 months from trial, and the time had come to reserve housing in Charleston. Years earlier, I had asked Randy what the probability was of the government catching on that I didn't do anything wrong and just dropping the charges. He told me that he expected the government to drop charges against everyone except me, John Kang, and John Sessions, the CEO, the president, and the chief operations officer. Randy would have included the chief financial officer, but he had previously died of cancer. I wanted to be sure of my odds, so I pushed Randy by asking if it would literally take divine intervention for me to avoid a trial and just walk free. He pondered for a moment and said yes, it would take an act of divine intervention. With that in mind, Donna and I headed to Charleston to rent a place to live for 4 months. We made it an adventure. We had both lived at the temple for more than 35 years. We had never been away much more than a few weeks at a time. This trial is what it would take to force us to relocate for such an extended period. There was, of course, the possibility that my departure would be much longer. As we approached the trial date, things unfolded in accordance to Randy's predictions. The government called in the second tier of indicted executives one by one and tried to get something useful before dropping charges. Of course, there was nothing to get, and we were all glad to see our colleagues taken out of harm's way. That left the three senior executives headed for trial on January 18th, 2010. I received a call from Randy mid-December. He had gotten indication through back channels that suddenly the government was interested in discussing a settlement. After checking it out, Randy said it seemed the prosecutors had had enough and they wanted me out of the case. We were feeling pretty confident about my position given the successes we had in the pretrial hearings. I told Randy that I wanted the charges dropped with nothing on my record. If they wanted a statement of facts, I would state that I had always believed that everything was being done in accordance with standard accounting principles, but I now saw that Bobby had been doing some things improperly. In other words, I would tell the truth and nothing else. Somehow, just 4 weeks before trial and 6 years since the raid, light was dispelling darkness. The government insisted that I voluntarily give up a portion of a 12-year-old stock sale, just in case the share price had been affected by Bobby's accounting inaccuracies. I doubted that the share price would have been affected, but if it had, that was money I didn't want or need. Then, as suddenly as the whole nightmare had begun, it was over. The government agreed to drop all charges against me. I didn't feel joy, and I didn't feel relief. What I felt was a deep sense of appreciation that in the end, truth triumphed. It may have taken divine intervention, but the truth won. Tempering this feeling, however, was the fact that John Kang and John Sessions were still headed for trial. I had been exposed to all the documents in the case, and the only things I ever saw being done willfully wrong were the actions of Bobby Davids and his group. I knew that John Kang and John Sessions had both just done their jobs to the best of their ability. I worked with Randy so that he and his team could do all they could to provide support during trial. They couldn't participate directly, but they were present and wrote up most of the summaries, motions, and other documents needed during and after the proceedings. The trial went extremely well. John Kang's attorney turned out to be an excellent litigator, and he pretty much handled all the cross-examination of the government witnesses, including Bobby and his paramour from the accounting department, Caroline. By the time the government rested its case, the defense attorneys felt that almost every government witness had been turned into a favorable witness for the defense. That being the case, the defense also rested. Given what had taken place in that courtroom over the past month and a half, no one could possibly feel that the government had proven its case beyond a reasonable doubt. With both sides having rested, the case went to the jury. The jurors did not deliberate very long. After only 5 or 6 hours, they announced that they had reached a unanimous verdict. Given what had transpired during the trial, that seemed like a reasonable amount of deliberation. On March 1, 2010, the jury gathered back in the courtroom and read the verdict. Guilty as charged. The defense was stunned. The judge dropped his head into his hands. What had happened? Post-trial interviews with the jurors showed that the case was pretty much over after opening arguments. The government had presented such a simplistic, overwhelming view of what had been done wrong in the company that most of the jurors had made their minds up right then. Just hearing the government tell its story had been enough for most of the jurors. It was very sad. Our legal system had not worked. The truth had not been uncovered, and John Kang and John Sessions awaited sentencing. Only one glimmer of hope was still burning. The defense had filed a motion for dismissal based on the statute of limitations, and the judge had not yet ruled on that motion. On May 27, 2010, almost 3 months after trial, Judge Norton issued his ruling and dismissed the entire case against John Kang and John Sessions. In that ruling, the judge took the opportunity to again and again chastise the government for what had happened in this case. Among his other complaints, he questioned why the government would keep so many people under indictment for 5 years and then drop all charges just before trial. Judge Norton pointed out that this had helped drive the pre-trial defense cost of the case to more than $190 million. I was pleased that John Kang and John Sessions were free, with nothing on their record. I was also encouraged that at least someone had noticed the absurdity of what had taken place. But it wasn't necessarily over. The government had the right to appeal the judge's dismissal. In case that happened, the defense had filed a motion for retrial. This motion was based on the bold argument that the jury had been mistaken. The weight of the evidence presented at trial did not support the verdict. On January 19, 2011, almost a year after trial, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, finally broke through. On that day, when Judge Norton signed his ruling regarding the retrial motion, Jefferson, Mason, and Madison must have breathed a sigh of relief. After 200 years of interpretations of what they had intended, the system had worked. Truth and justice would have the final word after all. It had been more than 7 years since Bobby Davids had walked into the U.S. Attorney's office in Charleston and begun telling his lies. That web of illusion gained momentum and ensnarled everything in its way, but it did not make it past the chief U.S. judge of South Carolina. Judge Norton had sat through the entire trial and heard all the evidence. The jury may have been willing to accept the government's story at face value, without holding prosecutors to a reasonable burden of proof. But the judge was not. In case his dismissal order was overruled, Judge Norton not only approved the defendant's motion for a new trial, but in a 19-page opinion, he tore the government's case to shreds. He stated that the government had not proven that there was any conspiracy amongst the executives, but to the contrary, the evidence supported that the executives at Medical Manager believed that the accounting was being done properly. He went on to state that he found the government's chief witnesses, Bobby and Caroline, to be non-credible, and that Caroline only appeared to be parroting Bobby's words. I read Judge Norton's ruling with a sense of awe and relief. Now it was over. In the end, the person who mattered most had seen through the noise and recognized the truth. I didn't know that a judge could put aside the jury's verdict because he believed it was not supported by the weight of the evidence. Judge Norton made it clear that he not only had the right to put aside the verdict, he had the obligation. This was the Constitution in its finest hour. It was framed to protect the citizens from their government. But alas, it is just a piece of paper. The judge is the only agent through which that protection can come to life. In my eyes, both the judges in this case are heroes. They showed why our separate branches of government create important checks and balances against one another. These judges had taken a vow to protect the Constitution, and they selflessly did just that. As it turned out, the government chose not to appeal Judge Norton's dismissal of the case. In the end, all the indicted medical manager executives walked away free. Chapter 56, Returning to the Beginning. When the smoke cleared, the whirlwind of life had dropped me off exactly where she had picked me up. After 40 years, I still lived just down the field from the house I had built when I moved to the woods to meditate. I was still meeting with people every morning and evening for services in the temple, including the large Sunday morning gatherings started back in 1972. But the original 10 acres the temple sat on was now surrounded by 900 acres of rolling fields and beautiful forests over which life had made a steward. The foundations of my life had remained completely undisturbed throughout this entire dance with the universal flow. The legal ordeal quickly became a distant memory, almost a dream. It had come and gone, just like everything else. I could clearly see that because I had inwardly surrendered each step of the way, no scars were left on my psyche. It had been like riding on water. The impressions only lasted while the events were actually taking place. Yet in the moment of actual experience, each twist and turn had reached deep inside me and forced me past foundational fears and personal boundaries. As long as I was willing to accept the purification power of life's flow, I kept coming out on the other side, a transformed person. How could I consider this a bad experience when it created such beauty and freedom within me? To the contrary, I stand in awe of all that has happened since I started this amazing experiment of acceptance and surrender. One thing is for certain. He who left on this journey never returned. The flow of life had served as sandpaper that, to a great extent, freed me of myself. Unable to unbind myself from the incessant pull of my psyche, in an act of sheer desperation, I had thrown myself into the arms of life. From that point forward, all I did was my very best to serve what was put in front of me and let go of what it stirred up within me. Joy and pain, success and failure, praise and blame, they all had pulled at what was so deeply rooted within me. The more I let go, the freer I became. It was not my responsibility to find what was binding me. That was life's job. My responsibility was to willingly let go of whatever was brought up within me. After seeing all I'd seen over the years, surrender to the flow of life was all that was left of me. No longer busy making other plans, I settled into the quiet life of increased solitude in which I once again found myself. It soon became obvious that life had provided me the ideal environment in which to write this book. The moment I sat down, the inspiration flowed in like a tidal wave. I began writing what I always knew I would have to write. What happened when I let go? People often ask me how I look at things now that I've gone through the life-changing experiences of these past 40 years. I tell them to read The Untethered Soul. How could I possibly explain the great freedom that comes from realizing to the depth of your being that life knows what it's doing? Only direct experience can take you there. At some point, there's no more struggle, just the deep peace that comes from surrendering to a perfection that is beyond your comprehension. Eventually, even the mind stops resisting, and the heart loses the tendency to close. The joy, excitement, and freedom are simply too beautiful to give up. Once you are ready to let go of yourself, life becomes your friend, your teacher, your secret lover. When life's way becomes your way, all the noise stops, and there is a great peace. In eternal gratitude for all the experiences we call life. Michael Singer, March 2015. This is Michael A. Singer. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Surrender Experiment, My Journey into Life's Perfection. This program was directed by Mae Wuthrich, executive producer Sarah Jaffe. Text copyright 2015 by Michael A. Singer. Production copyright 2015, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.